Okay, right now I have just enough room to sit comfortably here, if by comfortably we mean a first-hand experience of factory farming from the animal's point of view. As long as the guy in front of me doesn't, you know... Because I hate that moment. When the seat in front of you comes back, it's like there's a judge you can't see facing away from you, and he's saying, I sentence you to 4 hours of cramping and immobility. But so far, so good. Maybe he's not even gonna... Oh, no. Here he comes. Ow! Sir, would you mind raising your seat back a little bit? You're just totally crushing my legs here.
No. I was told by my doctor to recline my seat because of my lumbar allergies.
But that's not even a real thing.
I have lactose myalgia. I'm flying out to see my sister, and I was told she rented a special couch for me due to my spinal fatigue syndrome.
I'll buy you a drink if you could just go up 2 inches, please.
I do not drink. I was told that would be bad for my Hashimoto's thyroiditis.
So you're just gonna lie on top of me all the way to Phoenix? I never should have booked Sam's Club Airlines.
I was told I could recline my seat. I asked the pilot when I walked in. He said, yes, you can. I told him about my myofascial issues, and he seemed quite concerned.
Yeah, but now I'm in pain, so...
There is a little song we sing about that in my support group. Would you like me to sing it to you?
No, not necessary at all.
Pain
not at all.
Is like
Please,
the rain.
No.
Pain can never gain. When you're on a plane to Spain, don't let pain become the main thing. Pain is not mundane, it waxes and it wanes. So make pain go down the drain, and you will not...
Today on The Scramble, mid-air battles over seat space, an update on blood pressure, and critic Roger Catlin speaks his mind. And now he wears the oxygen mask the whole flight, just to be safe. Colin McEnroe, will you shut up?
All right, so, yeah, she should not have booked Sam's Club Airlines. They just don't have good seats. And that's something we're going to talk a little bit about later on the show. What we do on Mondays is... I'm still laughing from that. What we do on Mondays is called the Monday Scramble. We try to plan it as little as possible. I mean, we like to go into Mondays without a clear idea of what we're going to do, so we have to scramble around, hence the name. We did have a little bit of forewarning this time about at least one thing we want to talk about, and we're going to tell you about that in just a second. I want to tell you also that as of last night or this morning or sometime, we got Roger Catlin, who is a blogger and freelance writer living in Washington, D.C., whose work used to appear in the Hartford Current. But Roger's been doing some interesting stuff here, and he's got a new profile of Oscar Isaac, the star of Inside Llewyn Davis. So Roger's going to be our guest for the segment where we ask the critic or pundit or whoever to tell us 3 topics that they want to talk about. So they get to set the agenda. That's what Roger's going to do. That'll be in the second segment today. And then at the end of the show, we will have a conversation about, you may have seen the page one story today about the limited amount of space in airlines and how airlines, some airlines anyway, are shrinking the space even more and are cramming more seats onto smaller planes and what happens when that happens. But the first thing we wanted to do, and I do feel, not to toot our horn exactly, but that if there is some kind of journalism award given for coverage of hypertension and blood pressure issues, we should win it this year. This is our third show about blood pressure, or at least a third show in which we have devoted at least some time to blood pressure, including one show that was all about blood pressure. And one of the reasons that we feel the need to come back to the topic of blood pressure is a recent report by a 17-member panel. It's an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association in which a whole new round of thinking was introduced about the guidelines for blood pressure, what your blood pressure should be or be less than anyway if you are 60 years old or older. Joining us right now is Dr. William White. He's chief of hypertension and clinical pharmacology division, professor in the Department of Medicine at UConn Medical Center. He's also president of the American Society of Hypertension. And so he will have something to say about all this. So, Dr. White, first of all, welcome to the show.
Okay, thanks.
And maybe begin by telling us, because I was having a little trouble figuring this out, who are these people? Who is this 17-member committee, and who asked them to rethink blood pressure guidelines?
Well, the group is were chosen from a pool of several hundred people who are potential experts in the area of blood pressure, its treatment, its epidemiology, of course, which means its population effects, and also caregivers. So there was actually some nurses and stuff like that on the panel as well. although most of them are more like research academic type of nurses. They are, you know, in general, like the two co-chairs, one of them happens to be an individual who's done research in the area of hypertension for her entire career of more than 40 years. And then the other co-chair is the head of family medicine at a medical school in Iowa who has an interest in healthcare delivery. So, and I've talked to both of them many, many times about this document and what they're planning to do, and know several of the other members of the panel. So I can vouch for that they are very smart and contemporary and know what they're doing with the evaluation of information.
Well, now the headline out of this, if I understand it, is that if you're over 60, you've probably been told by your doctor something along the lines of, let's get your blood pressure under 140 systolic and under 90 diastolic, and that suddenly, because of the result of these guidelines, if you're 60 years old, you've got 10 more systolic points to play around with, right?
That's what they say.
When you put it that way, Dr. White, that's what they say. I mean, are you fully on board with this notion, or do you have reservations or see it as a little bit more nuanced?
Yeah, I'm actually kind of worried about it, to be honest with you. I've been practicing as a physician at this place in Farmington for about 35 years, and I have been conducting both research and education and practice in this field of preventive cardiology and hypertension. And I think that we all can recognize that we certainly don't have everybody under control as it is. And there's a lot of forces behind that. There's the patient, there's the doctor, there's the pharmacy, there's the cost of medicine, there's side effects and so forth. And while many people might just be jumping up and down now saying to themselves, I don't have to go on medicines for the treatment of my high blood pressure, or I don't have to go on an additional medicine, there is this lingering concern that I have that 150 might all of a sudden become 155 or maybe 157, and people will really not be treated to levels in which they are protected against the two biggies at this age group, which is stroke and the development of congestive heart failure, which are very morbid events in people between 60 and 80. Now, I think that above 80, there is much better evidence that the 150 number makes sense, whereas between 60 and 79, I would have left things at 140 if it had been up to me and many of my peers.
All right. Well, since you're the only guest we have on this, I'm going to ask you to kind of argue both sides of the coin here or explore both sets of rationale. So let's take the committee side for a second and kind of try to suss out what they're thinking about. I assume part of this is basically saying to a patient population and to their doctors, let's not have somebody be on a medicine they don't need to be on because there aren't that many medicines that you can take that don't have any side effects. Is that in fact part of the thinking here?
No, I don't think that that's what they decided to do. I think what happened is that they did something which, to give them credit, they did this very intensive evidence-based review process where they had these certain criteria where the information used in this document would be extracted by a bunch of unbiased people to determine, you know, what do we really know about the benefit of treating high blood pressure at certain levels, at certain ages, if you're black, if you're white, if you're diabetic, if you're not, et cetera. So they went through that very systematically over a period of a few years. And what they basically came up with is that once somebody is above 60 years old, there's only really two major studies that were controlled in the sense that people were either on a drug or they were on nothing. They were on a placebo that was done in a fashion that they considered adequate and well-controlled by standard definitions. And those two studies were done in the 1980s, one in the United States and one in Europe. And those studies started out with saying, okay, if you're 160, we're going to put you into this trial, because back in the day of the mid-1980s, everybody was focused on the lower blood pressure number, the diastolic pressure, not the top number. So that's why they felt like they could get away with giving people nothing, because nobody knew whether or not there was going to be a benefit or not.
Mm-hmm.
So in many studies of this particular nature, the placebo patients dropped about 10 points while they were being treated over a period of 5 years, and the people who got the drug went down about 22 points. So the difference between the two groups was just 12 points. And the group who got the active therapy went down to about the mid-140s, and the group who went on the placebo was in the mid-150s. So at the end of that particular period of time, the people who got on the therapy had a 40% reduction in the development of a stroke and a 50% reduction in the development of heart failure, a 25% reduction in the development of heart attack. And the study that was done in Europe basically had exactly the same findings. But they said, well, the way this was devised was that, you know, you get treated if you're of 160 or above, and you got down to 144, let's say, on the treatment. So it doesn't seem like we have much evidence for anything much below 150, because that was sort of like the average of a lot of the patients as well. So they couldn't really have a recommendation to go less than 140, because no study had actually ever focused on 140 versus, whatever the control group was going to get with a placebo-controlled study. So because they didn't have the evidence, they said, we don't have evidence for 140, but we do have evidence for somewhere less than 160, maybe 150, so let's use that as the key recommendation for this particular age group. That's where that came from. It wasn't because they had evidence that 140 was worse than 150. It's because they didn't have evidence that 140 was better than 150.
You know, from the standpoint of care, is there also a concern that you're treating a 72-year-old woman? She comes into the office. Maybe she's got a little bit of white coat hypertension, so she's clocking in around, you know, let's say she's clocking in around 140 over 90. You put her on a medication. She goes home. She takes the medication for a while. She wakes up one day and, you know, her blood pressure has dropped really low because the white coat hypertension was kind of creating a false high positive. And so she gets dizzy and falls over and breaks her hip, and you've actually caused a worse problem. Is that anywhere in the thinking, or is all this just about statistics and epidemiology?
Well, one of the co-primary authors did make that comment to the press. In fact, we were all interviewed by the New York Times last week by Gina Collada, and I noticed that he did make that exact comment that, you know, they don't want people to be over-treated and get dizzy and fall down. Now, the example that you just mentioned is something that is not addressed in this document whatsoever, and I think that's a severe deficiency in the document, because I am a big believer in this white coat effect, and I've been studying that almost my entire career, and there's no doubt in my mind that a certain proportion of patients who come into a doctor's office get a blood pressure measurement. It is not reflective of their true blood pressure anywhere except in the medical care environment. So that's not reality. So you're treating a number which is not the person's real number, and that happens probably in about 15% of people in this age group where it is actually where the doctor's pressure is too high and likewise too low. I mean, there are some people who have the reverse white coat effect. They love their doctor. They love sitting there chit-chatting. They're at rest. And their blood pressure is actually lower there than it is when they start working or get active.
Yeah, that's me, actually. You just described me.
It's called masked hypertension. It's a true diagnosis. And it actually, in my mind, I treat that masked hypertension as if it's the real thing, because it is the real thing.
Yeah. No, my feeling is, you know, if I'm going to have a stroke or something like that, I like to do it in the doctor's offices, right? People right there who can take care of me. So I get very relaxed about the whole idea as opposed to elsewhere. So
we don't want anybody to have a stroke anywhere. That's
no.
Like the worst thing.
I understand. Yeah. I understand that. But this is my own crude primitive thinking about this. So just in terms of sort of what these guidelines come down to, they're just guidelines, right? You're free to ignore them. I mean, you're free to treat patients the way you've always treated them.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that – so let me point out a couple of things. I was one of the reviewers of these guidelines about 10 months ago. And, you know – a lot of these people who are authors of this are my colleagues and even friends, actually. And I think that the way it was written, the way it was laid out, was absolutely fantastic. It was extremely well conceived. They have a beautiful algorithm for doctors to follow. It's not hard. It's very easy. So that said, I still think that when it comes right down to it, it depends on who it is, if whether or not it's a guideline or that you could follow but you don't have to, or, you know, you're going to individualize care. I mean, typically, physicians in the United States have treated the individual patient. But on the other hand, the way we're doing things in medicine is changing a great deal. So, for example, everybody's got to have an electronic medical record by the end of 2014. The way the doctors are going to get compensated is based on what their electronic medical record says. They're going to be kind of these various pathways that people are supposed to follow. So it depends on where you work and who you work for and so forth, because many physicians are no longer private. They work for a, quote, organization. And if the organization says, well, you just treated, you know, Mrs. Jones, who's 72 years old, who had a blood pressure of 144 with the medication, and number one, that's not what the guideline says. And by the way, you're costing the practice money because that's medication that maybe she shouldn't have gotten. So you just never know how, you know, how this is all going to end up in the near future. But I don't agree with that, what I just said. I'm just telling you that I think that that is a legitimate possibility in the future. I would hope that physicians try to stand their ground and do what they think is best for that individual patient in that office, because everybody's different. I mean, do you check the blood pressure when somebody's seated? Do you check it when they stand up and find out that it drops 20 points? Then they can get dizzy and fall. Maybe you should back off on their medication. Do they have a history of diabetes or kidney disease in which you maybe would like a little bit of a lower blood pressure than you do at this 150 value and so forth? So I do think that there's, you know, a real need to be, a physician who thinks about the individual patient and their comorbidities and all the other things that we've been taught to do in medical school.
That's a great place to end. Dr. William White, thank you so much for your time. Dr. William White is chief of the Hypertension and Clinical Pharmacology Division, professor in the Department of Medicine at UConn Medical Center. We'll be back with Roger Catlin.
When I go back to Baltimore, need no carpet on my floor. You come along and follow me. We'll go down to Galilee. Out in green, green, rocky road, your promenade in green. Tell me who you love, tell me who you love.
That's Oscar Isaac singing in the new Coen Brothers movie, Inside Llewyn Davis. Why are we playing that? Well, because we're turning the show over to Roger Catlin for a segment. As we do on Mondays, we let one guest pick three topics and talk about what they want to talk about. But one of the things that Roger Catlin's done recently is do a protracted interview with Oscar Isaac, a profile about him, talk to some of the other people who worked with him. It's appeared in the Washington Post. It's appeared in the Hartford Courant. I think it's appeared other places as well. So I think that is where we're going to start. Roger, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Colin. How are you?
Well, good, good. My blood pressure is a little high. Other than that, I'm fine.
Yes.
This is kind of an unusual role and an unusual performance, because this is somebody who really had to be able to credibly sing and sing a certain way and play guitar a certain way. And there's a lot of shots in the movie that kind of linger on the actor's hands on his guitar. So you absolutely know that this person is the person that he's pretending to be. And so in your article, I think you say the Coen brothers were sort of thinking, you know, maybe we'll never make this movie because that person doesn't exist.
Yeah. They came up with this idea of making this film about the early 60s and kind of creating this fictional character in the pre-Bob Dylan Greenwich Village. But they really needed somebody who was convincing. Now, you could get some actors who could sing pretty well, and but could they carry an entire song? And what they were doing is just showing, you know, they have entire songs when these people are performing in this film. The song, you know, takes center stage, and they play the entire song, not a part of it, and they don't cut away. It's not a montage. The camera's set on the guy, and he sings the whole song, and they've got to carry that. Not too many actors can do that. So then they thought of musicians. Well, can musicians do this? And, you know, there are some great musicians out there, but they can't really hold much more than a scene maybe in their acting skills. And I don't know what this says about Justin Timberlake, because he is in the film. I don't know if he was considered for the lead. But
no, because he had to play the dorky guy. That's the, one of the – somebody else has already pointed this out, but one of the central ironies of this movie is the dorky guy is Justin Timberlake.
Yeah. So they found this guy, Oscar Isaac. He'd been in some movies. And, you know, I don't remember him that much, but he's been you know, in supporting roles in a number of movies. He was up for the last Bourne movie, but didn't make the lead and was in it anyway. But he had some musical background. He had been in a band in college before he went to Juilliard for acting, and kept up his music a little bit, but and sang some songs in some of his earlier movies.
Well, you know, another sort of revelation always with actors, I mean, we know they're actors, we know that they're acting, but if you've only ever seen one performance by an actor and it has a particular tincture to it, you kind of always you have a hard time sort of shaking that out of your mind when you're actually dealing with the actor. Now, in this movie, Llewyn Davis, depending on your disposition and your overall reaction to him, he's either a guy who really has trouble getting any kind of winning personality across, or he's something that rhymes with trick. You know, I mean, those are kind of the two things that you hear. But, there isn't anybody who sees this movie and goes, oh, what a cool guy. I wish I could hang out with him. And so I don't know if you went into that with any sort of baggage about, oh, this guy can't possibly be a nice person. But I gather you did find a very different person there in Oscar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was just the nicest guy and very welcoming and humble and funny and charming in a way that Llewyn Davis is never in the movie. Of course, Llewyn Davis... In the movie, it's just a week in his life, like the worst week in his life. All the terrible things are happening to him, and so he has a problem dealing with people in his life during that week, including finding a place to stay.
Well, another thing that, you know, you're a former music critic, and you know, watching this movie, I mean, it is a movie that really, as you say, explores folk music, not in a dilettante-ish way, in a way that, you know, really sort of gets in there and spends some time with it. And you sort of wonder, and this is something that you deal with in your piece, too, whether it's going to touch off any kind of new interest. Not that there isn't already sort of a roots and Americana boom going on, but I saw the movie Friday night, and then right afterwards I went home and watched the documentary on Showtime that you mentioned, mm-hmm. which is, you know, first of all, Oscar Isaac, former not-famous musician in this sort of everybody who's the least bit interesting or famous in the world of roots music is on stage with Oscar, and he's, I think, in a pretty star-struck place. But you do sort of wonder, as somebody who watches music, Roger, whether this might kick off something.
Well, I was thinking of it in the way that Oh Brother, Where Art Thou kind of kicked off this mini boom towards bluegrass and that kind of roots music, with T-Bone Burnett also producing that soundtrack for the Coen Brothers. I mean, that was kind of presented in a similar way with performances during the film, but then also they had one of these concerts as well that they filmed for a documentary. And you know, the soundtrack album went on to earn a Grammy, and I don't know, did it get an Oscar too? Probably not. But you know, it sold a million copies, and it kind of started this kind of interest in that. I had asked T-Bone Burnett about that, and he said, well, he thinks that's already happening. I mean, he's happy to kind of tap into what he says is already this huge thing that's happening with roots music and groups like the Punch Brothers, who's Chris Thiel, he calls the Louis Armstrong of the 21st century. On mandolin, which kind of blew my mind.
Well, you know, we've actually had the Punch Brothers play live here in the studio for us, and I did know that they have a little cameo in the movie, except that they're not the Punch Brothers at all. They're this Irish a cappella singing group.
That's right.
But, you know, it is, as you know better than I do, music does tend to flow in this kind of currents of reactions to whatever's there. And so you have a music scene right now that is kind of dominated by heavily produced stuff. And, you know, electronic dance music is, you know, the thing these days. And so Skrillex can sell out, you know, a huge arena or something. And the way things do tend to work, I think, is that people get sick of that at a certain point, and a certain percentage of the audience anyway starts looking for whatever is the opposite of that. That's what
yeah.
I want to listen to the opposite of that, right?
Yeah, that's what Oscar Isaac said, that the way that this might become popular again is that as a reaction to all that dance music. And already, though, that the Mumford & Sons is seen as a big enough phenomenon to, you know, not only sell out arenas, But to have kickstarted some sort of Americana. I mean, there was that recent PBS documentary about Americana music called Nashville 2.0, in which they pretty much say that the Mumford & Sons and their success really helped bring focus to this, and they're this British group.
Mm.
And whose member also is the missing duo partner of Llewyn Davis.
Yeah, actually, we can play a little quick bit of that, I think. Here's the Fare Thee Well cut that we have there. This is a little bit about what Roger's talking about.
If I had wings like Noah's dove, I'd fly the river to the one I love. Oh, fare thee well, my honey, fare thee well.
So that's the kind of a little bit Simon and Garfunkel-y hit sort of song that sort of hit folk song that
it's terrific stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it just puts you in a spell.
And I did not realize it when I was watching the movie that it was Marcus Mumford singing the other point. Marcus Mumford from Mumford and Sons, who somebody referred to as posh boys with banjos. But
and Marcus Mumford's wife, which I didn't know even when I was writing the article, is Carrie Mulligan.
Well, that's convenient.
Also in the film.
Yeah, she's also in the film. Yeah, she probably got some good coaching on how to sing from
him.
Well, one thing I think we would both recommend is, I mean, the movie's interesting. Not everybody's going to love it. The Showtime documentary, if people get their hands on it, with the Punch Brothers, with the Milk Carton Kids, with Lake Street Dive, all these kind of with Rihanna Glennon, these acts that have either broken out or are about to break out.
Mm-hmm.
It really is an incredible menu of, I think, what is to come in that genre, right?
Yeah, and happening already. And there's just a lot of excitement about it. And there's just a lot of collaboration. You can kind of feel it in that documentary, just in backstage and as well as on stage, where they're just all kind of excited to see each other perform and succeed. And bringing these old songs back, too.
We're talking to Roger Catlin. We're going to shift gears a little bit. He gets to pick three topics. His next one is sad holiday songs. So, Roger, why has that sprung to your mind? What's your take on sad holiday songs you hear on the radio at this time of year?
Somebody asked me to write an article about it, so I did. And but I was always had an interest in it as well. I mean, amid all the cheer and the jingle bells and the same, you know, there's a lot of Christmas songs, but you hear a lot of the same songs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when some star puts out a new Christmas album, and there's always a handful that do every year, they're pretty much a lot of the same songs. And then you go to the stores, you just can't get away from it, you know. There are all Christmas radio stations, as you know, and oh my gosh. But sometimes this makes people feel sadder because everyone else is happier, and they're already a little bit blue about something. If you're not with your family, then that's part of it. You can't be together with your loved ones and such. So there's always been some songs like that. I'll Be Home for Christmas is kind of a starting off point there in a way, just a wartime view of it.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who will be home for Christmas, but only in his dreams. So there's a melancholy that music can kind of help resonate in someone.
Some of the songs that you mentioned kind of take that bull by the horns, like the things that kind of go wrong for Christmas. We have a clip from John Denver. This is probably the most sort of openly dysfunctional Christmas song that I can think of anyway. It's called "Please, Daddy, Don't Get Drunk This Christmas."
Please, Daddy, don't get drunk this Christmas. I don't want to see my mama . Please, Daddy, don't get drunk this Christmas. I don't want to see my mama cry.
So I'm even struggling to imagine what the intended audience for that song would be. I mean,
you know, I've heard more covers of that song than the original. It's funny to hear the original because he was pretty serious and straightforward about that song. The covers are a little more, they push it a little more so that it's almost comical.
Yeah.
You know, isn't that funny? Daddy gets drunk. But this one, you can kind of hear the sadness in it.
Well, Roger, I think it also raises a question, a sort of an age-old question about music, and especially the blues and about sad music, which is that, you know, sad music, it seems to me, can have one of two possible effects on people. It can make them sadder. It can remind them of something that they're sad about that they had momentarily forgotten about. Or when you're really sad, sometimes you want to listen to really sad music, almost as, you know, a way of treating it you know, kind of the way you treat certain diseases by increasing their symptoms, like overload your sadness decks or something. I mean, what's your take on that? I mean, what do these sad Christmas songs, what purpose do they serve?
Well, just like the blues, the bluesmen always tell you blues make you feel good.
Right.
I think for those two reasons you mentioned, the people who are shocked by sad songs and are suddenly bummed out by them are people who are very cheery, and hats off to them. But, you know, there's happiness and sadness all the time. And so with one emphasized so much in Christmas, to hear the other side of it is there's something real about it. It kind of touches you deeper in a way, and it stays with you a little bit. There's not quite as many as there are happy Christmas songs, but I think they have more substance in a way too, or they feel like they do.
Do you have a personal favorite sad or blue Christmas song?
Well, I'm thinking of River by Joni Mitchell. Yeah.
Why don't we play a little of that? We'll play a little of that, and then you can talk it. Here's.
It's coming on Christmas. They're cutting down trees. They're putting up reindeer and singing songs of joy and peace. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. But it don't snow here, it stays pretty green. I'm gonna make a lot of money, then I'm gonna quit this crazy scene. I wish I had a river.
Fantasies of escape. Not that unusual, actually, at Christmas time. But yeah,
it's not really thought of as a Christmas song at all. I mean, it was on the album Blue from what, 1970?
Something like that, yeah.
You know, was part of that great album. But I only started hearing it at Christmas time. People start picking it out at Christmas time, you know, at least 10 years after that. And now it's sort of a standard in a way for a certain kind of singer who will include it. It's been covered by a number of people since then. But it's, you know, it's got those kind of minor key jingle bells in the background, and it's about a person who's kind of left sad in the swirl of all this joy and peace and happiness around her.
And I think, you know, in that sense, and increasingly also, churches have started to do this. I've been hearing about this a lot this year. There are churches that now have Blue Christmas or Blue Holiday services that acknowledge that for a certain percentage of their congregation, people are very challenged by Christmas and by the holidays, and they can't really benefit as much from a service that's completely enriched in that sense of joyousness. They really need some acknowledgement of how hard this can be. So, I mean, and I think that's also true with music, that if you grew up, you know, with Andy Williams singing "It's the Most Wonderful Time," you know, if you ever felt sad, you felt very much like a misfit or an outcast. I think it's great sometimes to hear the sad Christmas song.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a favorite family video of my daughter singing "It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year." Of course, you know, close up on her through the whole song, just the saddest look on her face. forced to sing this song she didn't like.
Well, let's wrap up this conversation with Elvis, because you absolutely have to do Elvis and Blue Christmas, which actually I think does lift people's spirits. So give us a little Elvis here.
All right.
I'll have a blue Christmas without you. I'll be so
You can finish it in your own heads. We can't play the whole thing. Although, as you pointed out, it wasn't actually Ernest Tubb did the
yeah,
original.
Yeah, he has a sad version. I mean, it's a sad song. I mean, Elvis kind of gives a little swing in it. He doesn't really feel that, but it sounds that blue. But Ernest did feel a little lonely when he sang "He'll Be Blue Without You on Christmas."
All right, we're talking to Roger Catlin right now. Writes about arts and culture. Works out of Washington, D.C. after many years working here in Connecticut. Our third topic is going to be Saturday Night Live. Roger on his blog was writing about this week's episode of Saturday Night Live, a very special Christmas episode. We are reminded constantly it's a very special Christmas episode, so special that they essentially got two hosts for it, Jimmy Fallon and Justin Timberlake, either of whom is quite capable on his own of hosting. I'll kind of let you take it from there, although one of the things you were interested in is the cameo. It's become kind of a staple of Weekend Update, anchored by Seth Meyers and Cecily Strong and whoever's anchored it in the past, that suddenly people will kind of roll over on a rolling chair into the frame, and there's somebody there that you weren't expecting to see. So, Roger, tell us what happened this Saturday.
Well, this was all over this episode. It happened in Weekend Update, but it was all over this episode, starting from the beginning with Fallon was going to do one of his musical impersonations, and he's pretty very good at that on his show. But he was going to do Dylan and Bowie and McCartney, and of course McCartney walks out and, you know, insists on doing his own part, and they end up doing a fairly straight Christmas ballad. But,
which, by the way, I thought was kind of a mistake. I just want to sort of, I have to get my own little two cents in here, which is I think Jimmy Fallon is a genius at impersonations. And so, this, the conceit of this was that there were mics set up for David Bowie, Bob Dylan, and Paul McCartney. In addition to Jimmy Fallon, he was going to run back and forth among the mics singing all the parts. And then sort of after this has gone on for a while, Sir Paul pops up at his own mic and does his own singing. And at that point, Jimmy Fallon continues to sing with Sir Paul. Have yourself a Merry Little Christmas. And I was thinking, you know, no one really wants to hear you sing for real. we like the funny impersonations, but don't get that whole Garrison Keillor thing where you think people really want to hear you sing. Anyway.
That's what Stephen Colbert was doing all week, too. He brings in people to sing carols on his last week of the year and always stands in with them to sing it. The kind of thing they used to do on variety shows long ago. But, yeah, you're right. Nobody wants to hear the comedian necessarily.
So anyway, we moved on from there. We got Madonna, right, on a game show.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess there might be some other shows where there have been more cameos in one show. I mean, I'm thinking the one where Justin Timberlake himself got the award for hosting five times. Mm-hmm. And so there was a sketch with, Steve Martin and Paul Simon and all these people in one. But in one episode, we have Paul McCartney, Banana, you know, Jimmy Fallon and Justin Timberlake did their Robin Gibb talk show, and then which ended with Robin Gibb coming out, which was odd to me.
I think it ended with Barry Gibb coming out. If Robin Gibb had come out, that would have been a real cameo.
It was the Barry Gibb talk show. So. The fact that they're even doing this after Robin Gibb died was weird. But, there's just seems to be some sort of pressure to do these same skits over and over again. So they did, a new version of that, which has this kind of odd take that that Gibb gets very angry when he talks to people.
Right, which is not really based on anything. I
think they just got to make it up because his voice sounds funny.
The idea that the Barry Gibb would have a political talk show is a stretch. That's not based on anything. And that he has this explosive temper and he gets really mad is also, to the best of my knowledge, not based on anything true or false. It's just sort of this wacky idea. It kind of does work. And then finally, in the Weekend Update, Michael Bloomberg came on for a really, really meaningless and for the most part, colorless cameo appearance. But I thought one interesting point that you made, Roger, was that this special was also kind of an advertisement for kind of kneel before Lorne Michaels, your new TV overlord. This was Jimmy Fallon hyping the fact that he's taking over the Tonight Show, reminding everybody that Seth Meyers is taking over his old late night show. And meanwhile, of course, the SNL franchise just sort of keeps on going, too.
Yeah, it's Lorne Michaels' empire, really, kind of shifting its gears a little bit. I think part of the reason for all the cameos was Jimmy Fallon kind of showing the power he has to bring people on. You know, the relationships he's made on Late Night that he hopes to bring to The Tonight Show, that NBC hopes he brings to Tonight Show. Look at all these people who are attracted when I'm hosting. And then it was weird with Bloomberg because the three of them are standing there. And in the middle of, Bloomberg didn't even get off too many jokes, but Fallon did this whole thing about, you know, it being one of Meyer's last shows and that he'll be taking over his slot and all this stuff. It's like kind of stuff we already know, but it was kind of odd to do right there on the program.
One last thing that I would observe, and we're going to have to go here pretty soon, but the oddest cameo of the night, in a way, was a cameo by an actual member of the Saturday Night Live cast. And one of the game shows that they did, they had this kind of bland-looking, hard-to-recognize guy on who actually is a member of the Saturday Night Live cast. And kind of unusually this year, they added five or six new performers, and very controversially, they're all white people and mostly all men, and kind of hard to tell apart in a lot of ways. And they've unsuccessfully developed any of them. They haven't really, you know, in ways that Kate McKinnon and Cecily Strong broke out early in their first year in the cast, nobody's broken out. And this guy, the whole joke of his appearance was he was a member of the Saturday Night Live cast for real, and he just really hadn't been in very many, many things.
Yeah, he had to convince them of that fact because they weren't quite sure if he was really telling the truth. And he was the guy who's been used the least. But there are some very talented people that they hired. And the only way you get over that is to actually use these people. Use them, you know, give them the crazy characters. There's at least a couple of guys on there who are very funny, but you know them from other things and not this, including the AT&T commercials, the guy who sits there with the little kids.
Yeah, there's a guy named Kyle Mooney who's very funny.
Yeah.
Has a lot of funny stuff on the internet, but he's not getting to do it there. Hey, Roger Catlin, we've got to wrap this up, but congratulations on your Oscar Isaac piece, which is running all over the place. And have, as they say, a very happy holiday.
And to you and all my friends in Hartford.
Today's Scramble was whipped up by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our intern is Jackie Lauper. The part of Bill Curry was played by Steve Harvey. Greg Hill tweets for us, a WNPR Colin, and appeared in our intro. For links, articles, photos, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff trying to cram themselves into an airplane toilet, visit our great website, WNPR.org. Tomorrow, while you're doing last-minute errands or cooking, enjoy a conversation we had with Eric Danton and Joan Holiday about the best modern Christmas songs. And now, back to Colin.
Spoiler, the best modern Christmas song, the best new Christmas song of the last 5 years is Why Can't It Be Christmas? It's by Rosie Thomas. Why Can't It Be Christmas Every Year? Is that what it's called? Something like that. Rosie Thomas, check her out. Also, just to wrap up the conversation with Roger, because I didn't say this, Kate McKinnon is as funny. If you haven't watched Saturday Night Live in many years, Kate McKinnon is as funny as anybody they've ever had on. She's spectacular. Her impersonation this week of Billie Jean King was a home run. Anyway, we got to switch gears here. We're going to talk about airline travel. If you picked up your New York Times, if you actually have a physical copy of the New York Times, that is, this morning you would have seen on page one an article about the changes in airline seating space. This probably isn't anything that you needed to be told if you're flying a lot these days, but they say that to get more space, they're using a new generation of seats with lighter materials, less padding, moving the magazine pocket above the tray table, even reducing or eliminating the recline in some seats. The overall amount of space on some flights that they're allocating per seat is going down. We could tell you a little bit more about that. Let's sort of go to the expert here. Brett Snyder is the founder and author of CrankyFlyer.com. Brett, I don't know, how much did this article resonate with you, and how much of it do you think is, getting people really upset about something they already recognize as kind of a minor or major inconvenience?
Well, I think as with a lot of things in air travel, I think people are probably a little more up in arms than maybe they need to be about this. But there's no question that everything you said is right. There is less space that's being allocated. They're putting more seats onto the airplane. But it's this kind of new seat design that they're working on that is supposed to not reduce the amount of space that you have, even though there are more seats on the airplane.
Well, you know, one of the things that they talked about is that Spirit Airlines is now working with a backrest that is, as they call it, pre-reclined. In other words, you can't push a button and make it go back 3 inches. It's already set back 3 inches. And although I think in the article that was sort of cited as one of the new abominations, I kind of like that idea, partly because there is that horrible moment on your plane flight when the person in front of you decides to exercise that option. I'd almost rather be in that. I'd rather not have to wait for that moment.
It's true, and it's worst if you're just typing on your laptop and all of a sudden it gets crunched when they go back on you. But yeah, I never actually recline my seat on a domestic flight, and most of Spirit's flights are, you know, within the U.S. or shorter haul into the Caribbean, something like that. And that's precisely because it really does impede the person behind you, and you know they're just trying to kind of keep their head above water. And on Spirit's aircraft, they do have very tight seating, tighter than you'll find with most other airlines in the U.S. But you know that's part of Spirit's brand of who they are, of saying, we're cheap, we're going to get you there, but we're really, really cheap.
Is part of this the burden being placed to an increasing degree on the consumer? In other words, usually when people book flights, they're looking at price, they're looking at convenience. Does it leave when I want to leave? Does it come back when I want to come back? Is the layover in Minneapolis, you know, a reasonable amount of time but not so short that I'm going to lose my luggage or something? And they look at all those kinds of things, but they may not ask themselves a whole lot of questions about, wow, what kind of seats does this particular airline have? I mean, is it going to be the case that we're going to be turning more and more to sites like yours and trying to figure out exactly who it is we're dealing with?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think that's actually a good way to look at it. So historically, by that I mean, you know, since the industry was deregulated in the 70s, price and schedule are the two big things that people look at. So if it's nonstop, that's better than a connection. And maybe if it's a connection in Dallas in the winter, that's better than a connection in Chicago, not in the last couple weeks. But that's kind of what people look at. And so now what we're seeing is that airlines are trying to differentiate their products a little bit more. And Spirit's a great example. They're differentiating it in the opposite way that you might want it to be differentiated from a product perspective. But the price is just so low. And so people can look at that and say, well, what matters most to me? Is it having a more comfortable seat, or is it getting home for a lot less money? And I think we'll see more of that.
I just anecdotally, I'll tell you that on at least one occasion, rather than fly out of Bradley, which is the nearest airport here, and then have a connecting flight to San Francisco, I actually drove to Boston and flew JetBlue because, first of all, it meant I could fly straight with no connection, no chance of missing a connection, that kind of thing. And also, JetBlue is sort of, at least on that particular flight, and from what I've heard, you would know more about this, kind of the opposite of what we're talking about with Spirit, right? I mean, they kind of go out of their way to make the cabin kind of comfortable.
Yeah, so JetBlue has more legroom in every seat. I mean, they even have an extra legroom seat section on board that you can pay to sit in, but even their regular coach seats are going to have a good couple extra inches above what most airlines are going to have, you know, a lot more inches above Spirit. And that's JetBlue's brand, is even the basic customer is going to get a more premium type of experience in coach, whereas most of the big legacy carriers in the U.S., if you want to talk about United, American, Delta, they've kind of come to this conclusion that there are people that just want to get a seat for pretty cheap and they want to go somewhere. And fares today are actually very cheap if you look historically adjusted for inflation. But then they know that there are people that want more. But instead of providing that as part of the ticket price, they're now offering it more as an add-on. So you can pay for extra legroom. Or, you know, you can pay for food and drink if you want it, or you can pay for internet and whatever it might be.
It does seem the another thing that's happening. One of the things you get on a plane, this will have to be the last question, we're almost out of time. You get on a plane, one of your hopes is, well, I hope it's not a really full flight and maybe I can spread out a little bit and everything like that. But it seems, once again, this is all anecdotal, but it was confirmed a little bit by the Time story, as though planes are fuller because they're not doing quite as many flights and they're really making sure the plane's full all the time.
Yeah, that's not anecdotal at all, actually. That is completely true. If you look back, you know, even 10 years ago, maybe airlines would fill 70-75% of the seats on their airplanes. Now they're routinely in the 80% range, with some of the ultra-low-cost carriers up above 90%. And when you see that, it doesn't usually mean that there are 10% of the seats open. It means that on most of the flights, every seat is jammed. And then, you know, maybe a few off-peak flights have a bunch of empty seats or something like that.
Well, Brett Snyder, great to talk to you. Brett Snyder is the founder and author of CrankyFlyer.com. Go there for more details. Go there to make sure you don't get on the wrong kind of flight. Meanwhile, thanks to everybody who helped out today. We'll be doing a rebroadcast of a really great show we did about Christmas music tomorrow. So right now is my chance to say happy holidays. And thanks, as I always do, to the wonderful, wonderful women I get to work with, Betsy Kaplan, Kyone Wolf, the great producers of this show. And we'll be back with a brand new show about jazz, the best jazz of 2013 on Thursday, Boxing Day.
Yeah, well, I'll come over to my house and we'll dance by the light of the moon. It's a-
I'm Kyone Wolf, and I've been on this flight for like 4 hours, and the dude in front of me is totally crushing me, and... Ugh, finally, they turned off the non-smoking sign.